If you've taken the time to read your bulletins, or maybe you're a little more tech savvy and you've looked at the e-bulletin online, then you're aware that the title of this message is, Who Do You Think You Are? Now, by a show of hands, how many have ever been asked that question in your life? Right. I know I've been asked that question many times. Yeah, right. I've been asked that many times in my life, especially during my teenage years. And I don't know, but when I've been asked that question, it's usually preceded with the word just. Just who do you think you are? Now again, by a show of hands, how many times have you been asked that question knowing that the one asking the question was coming from a perspective of wanting to build you up? Not as many hands, huh? Yeah. You see, when somebody asks us, who do you think you are, is because they're upset about something that we have done, or they assume that we have done. And they want us to know in no uncertain terms that they are upset with us. And they want us to cease and desist immediately from whatever we are doing, or again, whatever they think we are doing. I can't imagine any of us hoping that someone will walk up to us and say, who do you think you are? The question is unnerving. We're naturally offended by this line of inquiry. And at our gut level, what we want to do is to take our finger and point it right back at the person who's asking this question and say to them, just who do you think you are? There'll be more time for confession afterwards. So. Well, I just want to say, it is not my intent this morning to unnerve anyone or to get anybody riled up or miffed off. However, I do feel compelled to ask this question to the church today. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Now, before anybody gets up and walks out, let me explain why I'm asking the question. You see, my intent in asking this question is not to point an accusatory finger. It's not to call you to straighten up or else. Rather, my purpose in asking is to hopefully encourage us to pause for a moment and to reflect on an alternate and even edifying reason for asking the question, who do you think you are? See, I'm asking the question this morning as a means of probing, as a means of provoking us to think deeply about how we actually see ourselves, both as individuals and as a body. Who do you think you are? See, in our context today, this is a question of identity. And as you ponder that question, I want you to consider the following related questions. They are, how do you see yourself? What do you believe about yourself? How do you see yourself in relation to the other members of this body that assembles week after week at Chinook Alliance Church? How do you think the other members of the body view you as they look at you? Perhaps you might be sitting here this morning thinking, I wonder if anybody ever thinks about me. How do we see ourselves in relation to the other churches in this community? How do the other churches in our community view us? And how do we view ourselves in relation to the surrounding community and vice versa? This is the vantage point from which I'm asking this question. I'm not making any judgments, but at the same time, I'm trying to open up the opportunity for self-judgment in this matter. So I'll ask again. Who do you think you are? Now, some of you may be thinking, now, is this line of questioning really necessary? Isn't it altogether obvious who we are? Shouldn't our time be more wisely spent on a sermon of weighty theological matters? Some of you may be even thinking, oh no, sounds like he's going to go off on one of those tangents there and talk some self-help psychobabble fluff this morning. Well, let me address those questions and perceptions as they were related to the importance of identity in a twofold manner. First, I do not believe that I am overstating the case when I say that we are living in a time of unprecedented identity crisis. I believe we're living in a time of unprecedented identity crisis. And I'm sure that every generation believes that about their generation, but I don't know, I've been around for a while. And I feel it's particularly true of our time. And as evidence of what I'm saying, I'm going to pick what I consider to be one very obvious example of the type of identity crisis that people of all ages and backgrounds are facing right now. And I know before I do that, I have to put a warning out there. And my warning is, when I mention this as an illustration, because I'm not going to go into in depth, but as I mention this as an illustration, you need to stay with me. Don't get lost in all the heated arguments surrounding this issue. So I'm just mentioning it as an illustration, okay? So stick with me. So the identity crisis issue I'm referring to is that multifaceted and highly emotional issue of gender. Again, stay here. I don't want to debate it. I'm not going to elaborate on it. But I know that simply by mentioning it, I have opened up Pandora's box. But I've taken the inherent risk because I know that we all possess enough knowledge about the debate that we can all readily see how it is related to this issue of identity. All I'm going to say is, when I was growing up, the issue of gender was clear cut. But we have to realize it's not so today. And it is a source of identity crisis for many. That's the only point I want to make about that, all right? I'm going to move on. So moving right along. The second point I'd like to make is that I know I am not overstating the case when I say that our identity affects everything. Our identity affects everything. And what I mean by this is how we view ourselves and our relationship to the world around us is the most powerful influence in our lives. I really believe that. Identity affects everything. And see, identity, or another way we can talk about identity, is that lens through which we see ourselves and the world around us. It's the biggest determining factor in what we set out to do in all areas of life. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. If you are an individual who believes that they can't do anything right, that they are not good enough, then it is highly unlikely that you're going to be motivated to work very hard at anything because, after all, No matter how hard I try, I'm never going to measure up. Or let me use an example from Eric's sermon last week. I just love it when people, you know, lay themselves open here and you can use them as illustrations rather than yourself. But anyway, last week you may remember, he was talking about the fact that when he was a youth pastor, he had in his mind, I am invincible. And because he had in his mind he was invincible, he thought it was perfectly legitimate to take a folding chair, set it in front of a basketball hoop on a concrete floor, and then start at one end of the court running full bore, jump off of it, and do a slam dunk, and then everything would turn out just fine. Or, you know, if it didn't turn out all right, he thought, well, I'm invincible. After all, the worst thing will happen is I'll just bounce up and just shake it off. But he soon realized what actually he had done is stirred up a recipe for a compound fractured forearm. Our identity, it affects us in everything that we do. It is a big deal. It is a big deal that affects us from our first breath all the way through to our final breath. Now, I'm going to make a bold statement that I believe is crucial for us to understand. So please listen to me carefully. If we fail to properly understand and embrace our true identity, it is highly unlikely that we will ever get around to being the people God has designed and called us to be. And consequently, equally unlikely that we will ever get around to doing the things that God has designed and called us to do. I'm going to repeat that. If we fail to properly understand and embrace our true identity, it is highly unlikely that we will ever get around to being the people God has designed and called us to be. And consequently, equally unlikely that we will ever get around to doing the things that God has designed and called us to do. Now, with that buildup, I hope that it will not be too big of a disappointment to everyone gathered here today, or maybe some of you will be listening to this later. But it's not my intention this morning to resolve this matter of identity in one message. It's just too big. I don't think it's possible to deal with all of the complex issues surrounding the this issue of identity that I could take care of in 25 to 30 minutes. So, I plan to unpack this in the weeks to come. So you got a little roadmap now where we're going in the weeks ahead here. But what I would like to accomplish in our remaining time together is look at some scriptural examples of identity confusion. So we're going to look at some scriptural examples of identity confusion. Then we're going to consider the outcome of their identity confusion, and then recall an important part of their God-given identity. So we're going to look at three examples, and all of these are found in the Hebrew Scriptures, which we also oftentimes refer to as the Old Testament. Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11, that one of the reasons that the narratives of the Hebrew Scriptures are recorded for us is to serve as examples. And they were written down as warnings for us. So, we're going to look at these examples and see what we can learn from them in order that we might avoid the mistakes that they made. Again, this is not going to be an in-depth survey. We only have time to scratch the surface today, but I believe that it will assist us in our journey in the coming weeks as we dig deeper into this subject of identity. So, if you have a Bible, we're going to begin at the beginning. And we're going to look at the book of Genesis. And the first example of identity confusion I want to consider is with the first couple, Adam and Eve. The specific account is found in chapter 3. And we'll look at the first seven verses. This is a passage that's probably familiar to many of us here, if not all. So I'm going to begin reading in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die." "You will not certainly die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. What is the identity confusion we see in this passage? To put it simply, it was the possibility and the desirability of a life independent from God. A life independent from God. She keyed in on those words, "You will be like God." It's an identity issue that many people still struggle with. Even people who claim to follow Jesus. For some of us, we believe that we can, or it may even be to the extreme that we have to be able to make it on our own. We embrace so-called wisdom like God helps those who help themselves. And I would imagine in a harsh environment like we live in here in Montana that this may be particularly prevalent form of identity confusion. I mean, after all, you got to be tough to live in Montana. Montana is not for wimps. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of us suffer from a form of identity confusion that includes this idea of a life of independence from God. Maybe not in our heads, but in the way we practically live our lives. Well, what was the outcome of their identity confusion? If we continue to read the chapter, it's a long list, so I'm only going to hit the highlights. First, alienation from God. Alienation from one another. Inner turmoil. A cursed living environment. Sweat, toil, pain. And the inescapably grim prospect of death. I'd like to make one further observation concerning the outcome of their identity confusion. Perhaps it is not the saddest part of the story, but I would say it is certainly the icing on the cake. And that is, in the end, the one thing that Adam and Eve really sought after, they never gained. After losing everything, they were still utterly dependent upon God. But then again, it only makes sense that this would be the case. You see, their God-given identity, at least part of it, was to be God's image bearers on the earth. That's what we're told in the creation narrative. It says, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And I want to say to you this morning, while that image is tarnished, while it is not as readily discernible to us today, we are still created to be God's image bearers. And to be God's image bearers necessitates a life of dependence upon and communion with God. That's the only way we can do it. Let me move on to the second example of identity confusion. And this is played out in the lives of another couple. If you can move quickly in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 16. And we'll look at the first five verses there. The name of the couple here is Abram and Sarai. Genesis 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. But she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abram, the Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her. Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan for 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, you are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now she knows she's pregnant. She despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. You can hear that, can't you? Yeah. If you're unfamiliar with the backstory, God commanded Abram at age 75 to leave everything that was familiar to him, including his extended family. And he was told to go to a place, and I'll let you know you're there when you get there. I'll show you. All along the way, God repeatedly promised to give Abram offspring through his wife Sarai, who was 66 at the time. So 75 and 66. And we read that Abram truly believed God. However, the passage before us takes place more than a decade after God had made the initial promise. And Abram and Sarai realized that they weren't getting any younger. So he's now 85 and she is 76. What is the identity confusion that manifests itself in their lives? Can be summarized this way. God needs our help to keep his promises. God needs our help to keep his promises. See, Abram and Sarai came to the place where they believed that God was counting on them to lend him a hand. Perhaps they had also heard God helps those who help themselves. Well, what was the outcome of their identity confusion? The immediate outcome was marital strife between Abram and Sarai. There was envy on the part of Sarai. There was pride on the part of Hagar. Abraham is caught between two women. No more needs to be said there. But the long term, stick with this, the long term outcome has been centuries of antagonism and fighting between the offspring of Ishmael and the offspring of Isaac. See, their problems arose from the fact that they had forgotten their God-given identity. Please listen as I read to you from Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 through 3. Here the Lord said to Abram, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and curse, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Do you notice the active and the passive agent in this verses? The Lord didn't say, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you, but I'm going to need your help to actually get it done. See, Abram and Sarai's role was to be the persons through whom God would bless all peoples of the earth. And you need to hear this. That is, God didn't need their help then. And guess what? He doesn't need our help now in order to keep his word. Final example we're going to look at this morning of identity confusion is from the life of Moses. It's found in Numbers chapter 20. Let me quickly give you the context for the story. This takes place near the end of the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. The unbelieving generation had passed away, and the Israelites were nearing the promised land once again. In fact, they are right back where they started. And they are facing the same situation they did 40 years ago. A lack of water. And unfortunately, this new generation was responding the same way. By grumbling and complaining. So, let me pick up then in Numbers chapter 20 at verse 6. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community, so that they and their livestock can drink. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels! You can tell this is not, he's going off script now here. Listen, you rebels! Must we bring you water from this rock? And then Moses raised his arm and he struck the rock twice with the staff. Water gushed out. And the community and the livestock drank. Again, the situation is almost identical as before. However, Moses' response is quite different than it was almost 40 years ago. Why? Perhaps it was due in part to the loss of his sister Miriam. That's what verse 1 talks about. He just lost his sister. Perhaps he was just fed up with leading a band of chronic complainers. But whatever the cause, Moses suffered from identity confusion in this crucial moment. Now, it may not be readily apparent, but it is clear that in that moment, Moses shifted his focus from trusting in God to trusting in himself. As he pondered God's command, as he remembered the past, as he looked out upon the angry mob, Moses must have said to himself, "Oh, if God doesn't come through, I'll look like a fool. I better trust myself." And instead of simply speaking to the rock as God had instructed him, Moses struck the rock twice with his staff. What was the outcome of his identity confusion? Interestingly, although Moses disobeyed God, God nevertheless provided water for the thirsty people. He took pity on them and gave them what they so desperately needed. However, Moses himself did not leave this incident unscathed. As a result of his disobedience, he was forbidden from entering into the promised land. All that he had dreamed about, all that he had worked so hard for, all that he had suffered through for so long, was now gone in a moment of haste. Moses would have to settle for only catching a glimpse of the promised land as he ascended up to the peak of Mount Nebo just before his death. See, 40 years earlier, God had clearly given Moses his identity as he stood there before that burning bush. The Lord said to Moses, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. And I am concerned about their suffering." And then listen to what he says. "And so I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." Somehow, Moses had forgotten that God was the deliverer, and that he was simply the person through whom God had chosen to bring his deliverance. I'm going to close this message by asking you all the same question I asked at the beginning. Who do you think you are? I mean, just who do you think you are? I want you to think about it during the week. It would probably be a good idea to pray. Ask God to talk to you about this matter of who you think you are. And as I said already, the game plan for the next several weeks then is to delve deeper into this issue of identity and to see what the scriptures have to say to us about who we really are.